So today we're going to apply to claim theory the gauge fixing procedure that we discussed yesterday. Well, I'll finish discussing the gauge fixing procedure, and then we'll apply it to string theory. So let me just review for completeness sort of the standard textbook route to BRST symmetry. So typically the statement is that you want to make sense of this kind of integral, which is a gauge symmetry. You want a gauge fixed by inserting some kind of a delta function. Let me use this notation. I have some group G, which is acting on the space X, where little x is a point in this space. And I'll denote the action of G on X this way. So Xg will be the image of X under G. So your gauge fixing constraint, will set some variables, some combination of variables to zero, some function of your degrees of freedom to zero. And hopefully, at least initially, you might want to hope that this gauge fixing constraint was selected so well that it selects just one point in each gauge orbit. So at least initially, this is the space of configurations, and this is the space of orbits under the action of the group. Then you want the fixing constraint to sort of pick a point in each orbit. So you want to insert a delta function of f of x inside of that integral, but in such a way that we want to make sure that the integral over each orbit of this delta function gives us one, that there is no unpleasant factor coming from there. So suppose I'm trying to integrate this delta function over a gauge orbit. Then in order to make sure that I get one, I need to cancel the Jacobian, which I get when I integrate delta functions of functions. Remember, the integral of delta of f is 1 over the derivative of f, or in many dimensions, 1 over the determinant of the matrix of partial derivatives. So here you need to put something like the determinant of the derivative of f of f of x of g with respect to g. And then this will give you one if the gauge fixing condition hits each gauge orbit once. Actually, it gives you one even if the gauge fixing condition hits the orbit multiple times, as long as the total number with signs is one. So it's actually fine if your gauge fixing condition does something silly like this. So now the idea is to take this one and insert it in here. Then the textbook derivation will tell you just let's make a change of variables. Let's make let's keep g fixed and change our variables from x to x to g acting on x to xg. If the original action was gauge invariant, this will not cost us anything. So I probably want to really write this way. Okay, so I'm taking the derivative of this action, evaluating it at g equal to 1. After doing that, the g dependence disappears. I have an overall factor of volume of g. And I can remove it. So this is sort of the standard way you get to this gauge fixed action. But now, if you look at it, you will recognize almost immediately the sort of action we wrote yesterday with the Birest, which had an odd symmetry. Right. Usually, what you do is that if you're doing a path integral, this determinant is a functional determinant. It's actually quite tricky to compute, and it's convenient to replace it with a Gaussian integral or some auxiliary Fermionic variables, the Gauss. Essentially, you use the formula integral in db dc e to the bac equal determinant of a. And so you rewrite this as an integral over x dx db dc and maybe another auxiliary variable, bosonic variable capital B of f of x. Then you rewrite this at b del f of x g over del g at g equal to 1 c. And then perhaps the knife of wind. Okay. And then perhaps also rewrite the delta function this way. Now, this expression, so the variation of f of x with respect of the gauge transformation, when the gauge transformation is infinitesimal. This is just the infinitesimal action of gauge transformations. If gauge transformations are implemented by some vector field on your parameter space, I can just write this as sort of the vector field acting on F. And perhaps I can also put some indices in the whole expression, so we don't get confused. Okay. So this is precisely the cohomological quantum field theory we defined yesterday in an attempt of making this gauge orbit topological. So in the usual textbook derivation, you look at this expression, you say, ha, it has an odd symmetry. Let's call it Birest symmetry. And you would discover that q squared is 0, and that keeping q squared equal to 0 is very helpful in quantizing things properly. Which, a posteriori, is kind of the opposite. It's going the opposite way as you should. So let me also recall the Birest transformations that we wrote down yesterday. Remember, the transformation of the C ghosts depends on the structure constants of the gauge transformations. Okay. And remember that this integral will not change if we change the action by some reasonable Q exact amounts. For example, sometimes it's useful to add a B squared, which makes the behavior of the B field better. If you insert the B squared, see what's happening is that the integral over B will not give us delta function of F. It will give us sort of a Gaussian in F. But this Gaussian is still such that the integral of the Gaussian over the gauge orbits is 1. So in quantum field theory, you can be a bit more relaxed about the sort of gauge fixing conditions you use. When you do electrodynamics, for example, this is quite convenient. So you can introduce some parameter psi. At intermediate steps of the calculation, you had this psi in your answers, but at the end of your calculations, if you did things properly, psi will drop out from gauge invariant quantities. Also, this kind of formalism makes it usually rather straightforward to make sure that definitions of the theory based on different gauge fixing conditions are the same. As long as you find some sufficiently smooth way to interpolate between different gauge fixing conditions, the difference between the corresponding actions will be Q exact, and the answer will not change. So once you have your BRST setup working, you can be quite relaxed about the specific sort of gauge fixing conditions you use. What really matters is to make sure that Q is a symmetry, that it squares to zero, and that the cohomology of Q gives you unitary answers. So these are the things which are not automatic. So if you make some mistakes in your gauge fixing condition, if you pick gauge fixing conditions which are not good enough, or if there was some anomaly, maybe the measure was not actually gauge invariant, all of these problems will manifest themselves into Q not being a symmetry anymore, into Q not squaring to zero anymore. These are called BRST anomalies. Okay. Any questions? I believe you might have done some of this. Did you do the relativistic particle, right, in concrete examples? It's a good exercise to do it also for gauge theory, abelian and non-abelian gauge theories, exercise which you can find in textbooks, in standard textbooks. Another couple observations are useful. First of all, sometimes you can get rid of this auxiliary variable B, meaning that, for example, if I add a B squared term and I integrate B away, all I will get is some F squared term, right? This F squared term should be fine. If F was linear in the fields, an F squared term added to the action will leave will just modify the kinetic terms, but it will not break down anything. So that's what happens typically in electrodynamics. If you're even luckier, F might not contain any derivatives. Perhaps there are some degrees of freedom which are clearly gauge, and you can focus on eliminating those degrees of freedom. For example, when you do string theory, we wanted to eliminate the metric and leave the scalar fields that describe the position of the string. So when you do some, so in the action we will write, B will be combined, will be paired up with the metric in a linear way. And so you can just use it as a Lagrange multiplier to really get rid of the unwanted degrees of freedom. whenever you do all of these kind of manipulations, whenever you integrate away B, then the transformation of the B ghost will be modified. And on the right-hand side, you'll find whatever the equations of motion tell you that B should be, that capital B should be. So in this situation, for example, sorry, I keep erasing it, putting it back, the equation of motion will tell you that capital B is equal to F. So if you integrate away B, you get an F squared in the action. The Bieresty transformation will have an F here. And the action will still be Bieresty exact. So you can do all sorts of manipulations of this sort until you get to a maximally convenient form for the theory. In a sense, the Bieresty formalism is only required to deal with the subtleties, the situations where the cancellation between degrees of freedom and gauge degrees of freedom are not quite exact. So if you can do a lot of the calculations of the cancellations by hand, that's fine, and you let the ghost deal with the remaining subtle part of the calculation. Thus, something else is worth mentioning. Sometimes it's hard to find gauge fixing conditions which are just right. So perhaps you have some natural gauge fixing conditions which are a little bit too strong. So for example, instead of saying that f of x is zero, you might want to say that there are some other parameters, let me call s's, and you want to set some function of s and x to zero for some s. So again, Fishkin condition is that there will be some s for which this function is zero. For example, I mentioned that in the string theory, when you look at string theory, you cannot use diffeomorphisms in a while to remove the metric completely. You can make it locally flat, but you cannot make it globally flat. All you can do is to bring it to some canonical form parameterized by a complex structure. So you cannot say, you know, metric equal to flat metric. You need to say metric equal to some canonical form up to a choice of complex structure. So here, f of x and s is equal to zero up to some choice of s. So to deal with a situation like this, it's straightforward. We're just going to add some other auxiliary variables, fermionic auxiliary variables, sigmas, with the Bieresty transformation Q of S equal to sigma. And we'll just do everything with an action which is Q of BF of X and S. So see, now we can do an integral over the space for degrees of freedom and an integral over these auxiliary degrees of freedom. I have an action which is much like that. And now see that now that I have a delta function in this delta of f integrated over s would precisely do the job of restricting this integral to the place where f of x of s is zero for some s. But the extra sigma contribution will make sure that we do so in the correct way. So I'm going to get an extra integral, an extra term like this in the action. Sorry. if this extra freedom I needed was finite dimensional, then I don't really need to use auxiliary variables to deal with the functional determinant, because it's going to be just a determinant. So I can just integrate away this finite dimensional collection of harmonic variables, and then I pull down a whole bunch of terms from the action, and I get to a product of this sort. Okay. So whenever you have sort of loose gauge friction conditions, which are too strict gauge friction conditions, which would give you too many B ghosts, the way the formalism deals with that is by producing B ghost insertions which cancel the extra B ghosts in the measure. So if my gauge friction conditions are too strong compared to the gauge freedom, because I have a B ghost for every gauge friction condition and a C ghost for every gauge freedom, I would end up normally with more B ghosts than C ghosts and ghost number anomaly. But when I do things properly, I end up with these extra B ghost insertions. These B ghost insertions do something very nice for me, which is they give me a measure of integration on this auxiliary space. So when I do the string theory example, this sort of construction will tell me how to integrate over the modulized space of complex structures. So I will say, let's fix a metric to be some reference metric, which is a function of the complex structure. And then this sort of reasoning will tell me how to integrate over the modulized space of complex structures. Right? Remember that what I want to produce at the end is a finite dimensional integral of the modulized space of complex structures. Followed by a path integral on the string worksheet. Right. So in order to know how to integrate the space of complex structures, I'll use this technology. Okay, so let me actually do it. Do you have any questions? This sort of extra insertions of ghosts that you need to make sense of calculations can be quite confusing at the beginning. They seem to be coming from out of nowhere if you read textbooks. But all of them can be understood just by this general philosophy. You know, you build a topological an action with this symmetry, and then you manipulate it. So now we want to make sense of the path integral over position of the string worksheet in space-time, over the metric, modulo diffeomorphisms, and while. So we are going to need a whole bunch of ghosts to do so. We need ghosts for the diffeomorphisms and ghosts for wild transformations. So diffeomorphisms are, the parameters for diffeomorphisms are vectors. So the ghosts will also be vectors. See, the ghosts always transform in the same way as so you always have as many ghosts as gauge transformations, and the ghosts transform in the same way as gauge parameters. So the gauge parameters for diffeomorphisms are vectors on the worksheet. So now that it's unfortunate that I use the same type of indices, but you know, here A was an index in the Lie algebra for the gauge symmetry. Here A is an index on the worksheet. I'm sorry for the confusing notation. So on the other hand, while transformations have a scalar parameter, right? You multiply the metric by some function. So the Gauss for Weyl transformations would be just some scalar on the worksheet. And we want to impose gauge fixing conditions to tell us that the metric minus some reference metric is zero. So we want to insert a delta function of this sort in the integral, which means that our B Gauss will be something like this. Will be tensors with true indices. So our action for the Gauss will be the BRST transformation of little b contracted with the metric. Sorry, let me put some tilde in. This is the reference metric. Or the metric minus the reference metric. So mu's are variables which parameterize the spatial compass structures. So what are all the actors now? I have C, C tilde, B, capital B. I have the coordinates on the compass structures. I have the partners. I have my X fields. And I have the metric. Okay. And so recall that the metric transforms under diffeomorphisms in the following manner. And then under Weyl transformations, like that. So for example, that means that the BRST transformation of the metric is going to be del A CB plus del B CA plus H AB C tilde. Right? On the other hand, my scalar fields and almost everybody else transform just by diffeomorphisms. Only the metric transforms under Weyl transformations. So our X, for example, will become X plus VA DA of X, which means that the BRST transformation of X is just CA DA of X. And pretty much everything else will transform by something like that.
Mm-hmm. What is the MS parameter?
So in the same way as here, when we introduced momentarily a partner for these extra degrees of freedom, I introduce momentarily a partner for my coordinates on the spatial compass structures.
So it's like the sigma.
It's like the sigmas, that's right. And perhaps I should have been more consistent about who was Greek and who was Latin. But I wrote these notes in separate layers, and I was not terribly consistent. So this, the role of these M's will just be to produce some B insertions at the end. I'll get through them very soon. Now, okay, so we can use this to write the BRST, the action. So roughly there will be something like this, which implements the gauge fixing, and then something like this. And then something that gives me the B insertions. I think I didn't forget anything. Okay. So this is the action for the ghosts, right? To this, you should add the action for the regional action. Yes.
Are the C and the partial and the derivative supposed to be equivalent? Are we supposed to have?
Yes, of course. I have no idea why I wrote them in such a. Yes. Thank you. So you see that the C ghosts are gonna be are gonna have an actual kinetic term. Right, they're going to be dynamical fields together with some of the Bs. But the C tilde is kind of boring. It appears without any derivatives. In a sense, it's just like, you can think about it as a, it behaves like a Lagrange multiplier that sets to zero the trace of B. So let's look for some simplifications. Simplification number one, let me get rid of C tilde. And let me set B to be traceless. Now, when I set little b to be traceless, Now, something else I can do to simplify is that. Similarly, the off-diagonal components of B, right? I mean, locally, this is diagonal, right? The off-diagonal components of B are just setting the off-diagonal components of the metric to zero. So again, I can just use globally, right? I can just use this B to set, you know. Because the gauge fixing condition is linear and does not contain derivatives, I can just use the B integral to impose it. You know, there is nothing subtle about imposing delta of H minus H tilde equal to zero in the path integral. It's just linear in H, and it's just going to set H equal to H tilde. So I'm going to get rid of my B, capital Bs, and I'm just going to set the metric to be the reference metric. So again, this can be done pretty much for free. So what's left? This is gone. This is gone. And I only have this. So I have an action for some traceless B ghosts coupled to some Cs. They're symmetric, so I really didn't need to put two terms. And then some residual contributions, which are only used to produce the measure of the. For the integral over complex structures. And now in here, okay, plus the action for the scalar fields. Okay. So it's important that Now all the contractions, all the times raise and lower indices and so on, we do it with the reference metric, not with the dynamical metric anymore. Now, after all of these manipulations, which we did a little bit by hand, we should make sure that things are still working, so that we still have a BRST symmetry and that it squares to zero. Notice that when I do this, because I got rid of the capital B loss, the transformation of little b will be different. Now, what are the equations of motion for the metric? The equation of motion for the metric set capital B to be the variation of everything else with respect to the metric, which means they set the variation of little b to be the stress tensor, the total stress tensor, which has contributions both from the axis and from the ghosts. The other BRST transformations will remain the same. Roughly, something like that. Etc. Okay. Do you have any questions? So this is probably the most technical lecture. Things will get a bit better afterwards.
Can you just say again why you can get rid of the capital B?
Yes. So capital B appears in the action only as only coupled linearly to the metric. So the integral of capital B and the metric is very simple. Right. So I'm just saying in a complicated way the fact that the gauge fixing condition is delta of metric minus reference metric. There is no Jacobian here, right? There is no problem in eliminating the metric using this delta function to remove the metric. So in a sense, most of what the ghosts are doing are making sure that the integral over the metric has been gauge fixed properly over to an integral over the complex structures. For example, if you look at equations of motion for the sea ghosts, you recognize that they're the same as the conformal Killing equations for vector fields. So the equation of motion will tell the ghost that they are ghosts for conformal transformations once you gauge fix, which makes sense, and so on and so forth. So the role of the ghosts are going to play is going to make sure that things work out properly when we assemble the Riemann surface out of patches using conformal transformations. So they sort of make sure that whatever operations we do in some coordinate system will give the same answer independent of the coordinate system.
What did Q of BAB give you the Riemann
sense? So because the equations of motion, so when I integrate away capital B and the metric, right, what happens if, suppose that in my integral, let me just say it properly. So suppose I'm trying to do an integral like this, an integral in e to the I b f of x, the b the x, right? And that I have, but no, sorry, I wanted this to be really linear. Integral e to the I bx, the b dx, right? Plus some action will depend on x. Okay? Now, if I don't put any insertions in my path integral, this is just the same as the e to the s evaluated at zero. But suppose now I have a b insertion. Now I can integrate by parts and trade this b for a ds over dx insertion. Just because dx of e to the I bx plus s of x is equal to ib plus ds over dx e to the I dx plus s of x, which means that the difference between these two is the total derivative and it vanishes. This generalizes to any number of b insertions. You can always trade a b, a capital B, for a derivative of the rest of the action with respect to the dual variable. The dual variable here is the metric, and the variation of the action with respect to the metric is the stress tensor. So everywhere we had a capital B originally in our path integral, afterwards we can just put a stress tensor. In particular, in the variation of little b. Okay, so good. So now we set the metric to the reference metric, and at least locally, the reference metric is just flat. Right? We learned that it's convenient to work in complex coordinates. So let's do that. What happens to this action when we work in complex coordinates? Well, B is a traceless symmetric tensor, just like the stress tensor. So in the same way as the stress tensor had these two components, T and T bar, in complex coordinates, which are T of SS and T of S bar, we'll have a B and a B bar. And the same, and similarly, C has two components, holomorphic and anthelomorphic. Let me just call them C and C bar. So that the action becomes something like B del bar C plus B bar del C bar plus del X del bar X. One half, whatever. So it's good. It's free. Okay? We have again a free action. We can do calculations. The only thing we need to remember about this more complicated form of the action is the stress tensor. So we can do the variation of this with respect to the metric once and for all. And we'll find that the stress tensor has this interesting form. There is a contribution from the axis, of course. I should just remember to put Lorentz indices. And then the important part is the stress tensor for the ghosts, which looks like this. Somehow this one and this two remember the fact that C was a vector and B was a true component tensor. Remember that there is also a ghost number symmetry, which rotates B and C in opposite ways. It's a symmetry of this action. And if you write down the corresponding current, it's just CB. Finally, we need to make sure that there is a Bieresty symmetry. I can write down the Bieresty transformations up here in holomorphic coordinates. So we can try to check if this action, seriously, is really Bieresty invariant. So let's begin with the variation of this term. So what happens to this term when I do a Bieresty transformation? it goes to C del X del bar X plus C bar del bar X, sorry, del X, right. I'm gonna skip it. Well, I don't know if I should skip steps. Probably not. But I was writing it. I was making a mistake there. So let me correct the mistake. So let me transform X. What do I get? I get something like, let me forget about factors of 1/2. I probably had them wrong anyway. So I have a d of c dx plus c bar d bar x plus complex conjugate. Okay. Now, this is equal to d of c del x del bar x plus del x del bar c plus complex conjugate. Okay. Now, this is a total derivative.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, can you clarify why we can separate b and c in holomorphic and holomorphic?
What do you mean? I'm not sure I separated them. I just gave them names. So there was a BSS and a BSS bar, S bar, S bar. And I called them B and B bar.
Yeah, but for the T, since it's traceless and conserved, you know that TSS derivative bar is zero.
Oh, that's right. Well, the equations of motions also impose that the bar B is zero. So B will have the same properties as the stress tensor, as it should, because the variation of little B is the stress tensor. So whenever you see a mismatch between the properties of B and the properties of the stress tensor, it's an indication of trouble. For example, if the stress tensor is not transforming as a tensor, and B is transforming as a tensor, there will be trouble. Right? The Weyl anomaly, if you remember a couple of lectures ago, was manifested in the fact that the stress tensor would not transform as a tensor. So you can already see here that the Bresti symmetry will work if the Weyl anomaly cancels, which makes sense. Ultimately, will if you do it, do a concrete calculation, you see that Q square vanishes only if the Weyl anomaly cancels. Okay, now, so they said this is a total derivative, and this is canceled by the variation of B, at least by part of the variation of B, because this is the stress tensor for the axis. Then you can repeat the exercise for the transformation of the Ghosts, and you get some extra terms, and you'll find at the end that everything is a total derivative. Actually, the total derivative is kind of interesting because that tells you the Bresti current. Remember, when you do a symmetry transformation, to find another procedure to find the conserved current is to do a symmetry transformation with a position-dependent parameter. Right? So whatever was a total derivative which drops out with a constant gauge transformation survives when it's a position-dependent gauge transformation and gives it the current. So this term, for example, tells us that, I mean, we can use this with a bit of work, one can extract the Bresti current. It's not terribly instructive, perhaps, but I can at least sketch how it looks like. Like all currents, it has an holomorphic and an anti-holomorphic part. And it starts with something like Ct And then there is some b c to c, roughly. So it takes some manipulations to extract it. Not very instructive manipulations. But the final answer looks like this. Okay. Now it's worth pointing out that the fact that the stress tensor is EQ exact is precisely the way the BRST formalism is implementing the classical constraint that the stress tensor vanishes. So we would not have to impose it by hand, it will be automatic. Whatever is in the image of the stress tensor, in a sense, that will turn out to be exact. So we will need a bit of extra time next day. We will spend, I think, most of the next lecture to discuss the quantization of these ghosts, you know, which sort of theory is associated to this action. And then after we understand how the ghosts work, we'll be able to recover the string spectrum properly and to formulate scattering amplitudes. Because remember, that's our goal. One of our goals, at least, is to try to figure out how to compute scattering amplitudes, not just the spectrum. And to compute scattering amplitudes, you really need to know things like how to integrate over the space of complex structures. So you need the ghosts. Okay. Do you have any questions?
Are you acting on Q on S, and then you're inputting the like the transformation of D on QS on QX?
Yes. So I'm trying to see how S transforms under the BRST transformation. So I act on X. And I put it in here. So here, this will give me something like stress tensor times del bar C plus B del bar of C del C.
Mm-hmm. What happened to the
new? Oh, that's right. Well, so it means that when I do my... That's right. So let's write something sensible. So we had this, well, we're trying to do this path integral. Our final answer is going to be an integral over the space of mu's, of complex structures, a path integral over x, b and b bar, c and c bar, with this action. And we will just pull down these insertions to make an integration measure. So we'll have a bunch of insertions that look like product of B times derivative of the metric with respect to the complex structure, or the reference metric with respect to the complex structure, of course, integrated over the surface. I should have put the product outside. Okay. So this thing is called a Beltrami differential. So our calculation will require us to compute some correlation function of some big ghosts, which will give us a number which multiplies these Beltrami differentials and gives, I'm saying it very poorly. So our calculation will require this path integral on a worksheet with these ghost insertions. In three-level calculations, which is what we're interested in, it will be very easy to deal with them. Because the space of construction is very easy to parameterize. in general number of loops, it can get complicated.
Is that integral over the world sheet? Or?
Yes, that's right. Right, when I wrote the action, sorry, I there was always an integral of the world sheet. First. That's right. So, so essentially, right. So, what are the challenges that we still have to understand? Well, the quantization of the Gauss is going to be straightforward. It's a free theory. That's not going to be actually particularly challenging. It's a non-unitary theory, which presents some unusual phenomena, but is otherwise straightforward. It will be a bit trickier to understand how to do path integral, how to compute correlation functions of field theory, which lives on a complicated worksheet. But with a little bit of help from conformal field theory, we'll learn how to reduce a calculation like that to a calculation on a sphere and then on a plane. So at the end, we'll just have to do correlation functions with free theory in flat space with some something special going on in a bunch of points, which correspond to the semi-infinite tubes.
Here, to get to the expression, to introduce the integration over S and sigma,
yes,
just use that trick there of writing the determinant as integral.
Yes.
But doesn't this mean that you should have one sigma for each S?
Yes. It's true. And then after I write something meaningful, I can integrate away the sigmas. So I'll end up with having a few. So the contribution of the sigma will just be this. Essentially, you can think about this as saying, I don't have to write the whole determinant as a functional, as a Gaussian integral. Some parts of this determinant might be particularly simple, and I can write them down by hand. So the.
Are you going to get the critical dimensions from this calculation?
Sure. So, as I mentioned, the very basic condition is that T has no central charge. Mm-hmm. So, what you need to figure out is what are the contributions to the central charge from the Gauss. So essentially, we need to just compute the Virasoro algebra that comes out of this definition of the stress tensor. And each of these x's will contribute 1, and this will contribute minus 26.